Welcome again, everyone. It's always so good to see you. So we're carrying on tonight with our reflections on the Scripture of Great Wisdom, the Heart Sutra. We'll pick up where we left off. And when we ended last time, we were in free fall. We'd gotten to the end of the nose, and all the rugs had been pulled out from under us. All the floors were gone. Actually, it reminds me of a wonderful story in the Pali Canon where the Buddha asks a monk, you know, if you had a windowless shed, on what would the sun fall? And the monk says, well, of course it would fall on the outside wall. And the Buddha says, well, what if you had a window? And the monk says, it would fall on the floor inside. Well, what if you took away the floor? It would fall on the ground. What if you took away the ground? It would fall on the water, because that was the cosmology then, that water was underneath the earth. What if you took away the water? It wouldn't land anywhere, Sir Buddha. And I love that image of the sunlight not landing anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Heart Sutra is really pointing us towards, is nowhere to land. We don't create a self, so there's nowhere for things to land. And we don't get hooked by things. We don't form attachments. And, instead of being Velcro, we're like silk. Things just kind of roll off. Anyway, I find that a lovely image. Nowhere for the sunlight to land. I did want to tie a couple of loose ends from last time. And one of them is this sense of emptying out that we've come to, you know, as the rug is pulled out from under us. There's a way in which the Heart Sutra takes everything that we, every way in which we attempt to get a hold of reality, and takes it away from us. And that process of emptying out, it's in a sense a process of the emptying out of the self, is something that you find in, I can't say for sure, all mystical traditions, but I think it's quite universal. So it's not unique to Buddhism, but for mystics, there's an emptying out of self. And once the self is emptied out, there's only vast space into which God can pour itself. Or if the word God bothers you, you know, find another word that works for you. But this image of a vast empty space into which the numinous Buddha nature, the unborn, can pour in, I find very compelling. But I also, I think that this requires a kind of quiet and a kind of stillness in order for that for which we most long for to appear. So with that emptying out, there's space for that which we most long for to appear. I also wanted to go back to something that Akamura says in his book, Living by Vow. He says, we are all connected, so that there is nothing to gain and nothing to lose. Everything is coming and going in a natural circulation. Okay, so we're all connected. We've heard that a lot. There is nothing to gain and nothing to lose. Everything is coming and going in a natural circulation. And I think he's pointing to something very important there, because essentially he's saying, I think that it may seem like we're losing something, but somebody or something else now has it. Or it's changed its form and become useful in some other way, or that kind of fluid, ecological, we were talking about ecology earlier, the relationships of ecology, that kind of fluid ecological relationship that all things have with each other. And it made me think of something like, you know, we are very aware of whether we've got something or not, whether it's ours or not, whether it's in our lives or not, you know. But I was thinking about the heart. Has the heart ever gotten up and shaken its fist and been mad and distressed because the blood left and went down to the foot? I mean, I know that's kind of a silly analogy, you know, like, that dang blood, it's abandoned me again, it's no good, good for nothing. I'm, you know, in grief. The heart is in grief because the blood has gone on. And again, I'm being silly, but there's something about the recognition that, you know, it's like a cell in the body, you know, a cell gives and takes chemicals and whatever, and so the cell may lose something, but it gains something else, or it affects some part of the body in a certain way, so something else can work. If we look bigger than ourselves, we gain nothing and we lose nothing, because everything is coming and going within this larger system. So the question I ask is there a place we can come to where it doesn't actually matter what we have for ourselves? Because when we lose something we love, it's helping something, someone else or something else in this great vast organism which we call the universe. And this actually even includes our own life. And it's pretty hard for us to go there, but I think it's something to contemplate, that we can trust actually the letting go of our own life into this vaster organism that then absorbs it in a new and fresh way and carries it on in some other way and in some other form. Okay, so we'll move along in the scripture of great wisdom. The next line is, in the mind of the Bodhisattva, who is truly one with wisdom great, the obstacles dissolve. And going on beyond this human mind, he is nirvana. That's how Reverend Master Jiyu translated this section of the sutra. And 5 years ago when we had our first January intensive, because I've always longed for gender-neutral or gender-inclusive scriptures for the OBC, because of that, and with the agreement of others who were there, we shifted this translation a bit to read in the mind of Bodhisattvas, and remember, a Bodhisattva is a Bodhisattva, in the mind of Bodhisattvas who are truly one with wisdom great, the obstacles dissolve. And going on beyond this human mind, we are nirvana. And for me, more important than the gender neutrality in that way of saying it, was the way that it's about us. It includes everything that's about us here right now. It's not about he, a Bodhisattva, somewhere else in some other time. And I think it's really important that we know at some very deep level that we're participating in this. We're the Bodhisattvas. And when our minds are one with wisdom great, the obstacles dissolve. This isn't about somebody else. And I was gratified to see, to discover later that my own master and also Shohaku Akamura agree with this perspective. At some point in here, he talks about how this is referring to all of us. So we're doing it. We're doing it right now. I thought I could finish this scripture really quickly, and then I started thinking about it, reflecting on it, and realized that I want to go through it more carefully than I had originally thought. So I'll try to do that now. I just want to point out that the word mind here means the heart too, shin, heart-mind, or big mind, or Buddha mind. Something like that. So think in terms of this vast, spacious mind that we all have, that's something more than just our logical mind, our rational mind. Okay. Wisdom great is emptiness or prajna. Okay. So what the sutra is saying right now is that when we are one with emptiness, obstacles dissolve. All the obstacles dissolve. And being one with emptiness is a practice. It's not a state we attain and remain in, and it's not a thing. Okay, it's a practice. So how do we practice it? And I kind of brainstormed a little list here to which you all could, I mean, it would be interesting to go around the circle and add to it. But for now, I'll just share my list. So how do we practice the mind one with wisdom great? How do we practice emptiness? By not clinging, by letting go of what arises, which may be redundant, those may be the same thing, by not believing everything we think, by recognizing a view or opinion when it arises as a view or an opinion, by saying to ourselves, this is not as I see it, with everything we experience, by reminding ourselves that I am that with everything that we experience, by which I mean that we are connected, and also we are what we hate or reject or oppose. So when we find ourselves in aversion towards something, reminding ourselves that we too are that. All of which to me amounts to taking care not to create an other. I think that creating an other is the root of a lot of evil in this world, if I can put it that way. Okay, we practice it by relaxing the mind so that it becomes big and open like sky. This is taking a slightly different tack here. Or by looking at the sky, as we talked about last time. By reminding ourselves of the vastness of space. By reciting the Heart Sutra daily. By meditating. By practicing generosity. I think there's something about the openness that comes with practicing generosity that guides us into a sense of what emptiness or shunyata is all about. Okay, so the scripture's promising us that the obstacles will dissolve, and I thought it would be helpful actually to take a look at what's meant by obstacles here. And some of the other translations. Did I give away my own? No, here it is. Some of the other translations use the word hindrances. Hindrances, obstruction, walls, as well as the word obstacles. Okay? So an obstruction, on one level, is anything we think is keeping us from enlightenment, that we think is keeping us from enlightenment. I think in our common everyday usage, it's that which keeps us from getting what we want. And in everyday life, it's things like anything that vexes us, being stuck in traffic on the way to an important meeting, sharp words with a partner or spouse, a child addicted to heroin, a grandchild born with a disability, a crowded grocery store, being out of work. So from the trivial to the very serious. So lots of things, big and small, that cause us grief, irritate us, vex us. We call them problems, hassles, trials, that sort of thing. So that's a kind of everyday sense of what an obstacle would be. But in Buddhism, it's actually a technical term referring to the five hindrances. And the five hindrances are vices that disturb the mind and obscure one's vision of the truth. That's the Dictionary of Buddhism definition of the five hindrances. Vices that disturb the mind and obscure one's vision of the truth. They are desire, lust, greed. That's the first one. Second is hatred, anger, and all the forms of aversion. The third, I love this one, sloth and torpor. Isn't that wonderful? Sloth and torpor. The fourth is restlessness and worry. And the fifth is doubt, negative doubt, the kind of doubt that eats away at your practice, your training, your faith, your willingness to go on. In addition to the five hindrances, there are what are called the defiling passions. These are also obstacles or hindrances, and they're much, in some ways, they're like the same as the five hindrances: anger, hatred, greed, desire, lust, envy, jealousy, those kinds of negative emotions that can embed us deeply in suffering before we know what's happened. Master Sheng Yan, one of the modern Chinese Chan masters, says, whatever we cannot let go of becomes an obstruction. And that's, to me, a nice shorthand. Very well, you know, pithily said. He also says, furthermore, you cannot have one without the other. Now, he's referring here to mind and obstructions in the mind of the Bosatsu, who is truly one with his wisdom great, the obstacles dissolve. So you can't have one without the other. If there is no mind, there will be no obstructions. And if there are no obstructions, there can be no mind. Now that's pretty profound, and I can't say I'm there yet. So I can't vouch for this, but it's something to contemplate. He continues, as ordinary practitioners, we can only contemplate the mind with obstructions, since any thought associated with a self, or any attachment, or any vexation is an obstruction. Whatever you cannot let go of is an obstruction to wisdom, the awakening of Bodhi. We are always involved with or are at odds with one thing or another and never fully at ease. But when all attachments depart, we call that the mind without obstruction. Now, another writer, a commentary on the Heart Sutra, translates this the beginning phrase of this section as the bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita and the mind is no hindrance. He doesn't say the obstacles dissolve or the hindrances disappear. He says the mind is no hindrance. And I think this is a really interesting and important distinction that he's making, because it's pointing to what the Heart Sutra is actually trying to teach us, that it's the way that we regard reality that is the problem, not reality itself. So the mind is no hindrance when the mind itself is the hindrance when we are outside of prajnaparamita. It's the mind that's causing the trouble, not the reality itself. So another writer distinguishes three kinds of hindrances: karmic, which are the residuals of past unwholesome behavior, defilement based, which are things like greed, hatred, and delusion, and cognitive, namely the belief that things exist separately from the observing consciousness. Things that, you know, the subject object, I'm observing, that's separate from me. And the Heart Sutra is saying that the real problem in human conditioning is a misperception or miscognition of the nature of phenomena. So this is actually saying the same thing. It's our misperception that's causing the problem. We're misperceiving the nature of phenomena, driven by currently generated defilements, that namely greed, hatred, and delusion, seeded by past defilements, namely those karmic residuals. If that's too complicated, don't worry about all those details, but I thought it was an interesting sequence from karmic seeds to present greed, hatred, and delusion to a misperception of reality. And when we can shift that misperception, the obstacles disappear. The hindrances fall away. Okay? Another way of looking at obstruction or hindrance or obstacle in this context is thinking that there are beings to be saved and that we are saving them. You know, the helping hand strikes again. I'm the great one. I'm saving all beings. Or look at all the good I'm doing, or however that, you know, arises for us. And the I'm helping others syndrome. And I think that what this means is we can give up the kind of hard effort of thinking we've got to save all beings, right? Recognize the emptiness of both self and all beings. And then we're free to play freely in the field of samsara as if we are in nirvana. And I'll say a little more about that as we go along. Okay. Finally, the mind without obstructions is the mind that abides here and now. The non-abiding mind. To abide somewhere is to obstruct. It sets up a kind of hardness or a stopping of the flow, right? And we can remember that obstacles are also empty, as is emptiness itself. We're in free fall again. The true nature of the mind is non-abiding. And when we meditate, that's actually what we're doing, is not abiding anywhere. Unless we get stuck somewhere in our meditation. And just a couple little other variations on the translation. Thich Nhat Hanh says, we see no more obstacles in the mind, which is a little bit like the mind is no hindrance. But we see no more obstacles. And Ta-Nehisi says, live with an unhindered mind. We live when we're one with Prajnaparamita, we live with an unhindered mind. Okay, so Reverend Master Jiyu says, when we go beyond this human mind, we are nirvana. Okay, so to go beyond this human mind is to be nirvana. She says we are nirvana. And we began to talk about nirvana last week in our discussion. But I want to say a little bit about nirvana. First of all, that it's not a thing. Again, it's not a thing like Prajnaparamita isn't. It's not a thing. It's not a place. It's not a state that we get to. It's not a deva land, a heaven realm that we arrive in and there we are. It's a practice. Now, the meaning of the word, the etymological meaning of the word nirvana is something like to cease or to blow out or to extinguish. It also means to unbind. And the analogy that's given here is like a mind like fire unbound, meaning fire released from its dependence on its fuel. So fire has to have wood or something like that to burn. And therefore the fire is always trapped by the wood. But in the meaning of the word nirvana as to unbind, it's meaning no longer clinging to anything. Ta-Nehisi, I'm reminded that he translates shunyata as unbounded, and you've all talked about that in here, and that's I see a connection between those two, that idea of nirvana and what Ta-Nehisi's trying to drive at by using that word. Okay, so fire unbound, a mind like fire unbound. Nirvana also refers to deliverance from samsara, the world of birth and death and suffering, and the end of grasping onto a self. Once again, there's the self thing. Nirvana is the mind without obstacles, the mind of non-abiding. And you may remember that Akamura, not in the reading for this week, but for last time, describes three kinds of nirvana. And the third kind of nirvana is no place to live or stay. that sense of non-abiding. And he says, a bodhisattva doesn't stay in samsara because of wisdom or prajna or emptiness, and doesn't remain in nirvana because of compassion. So a bodhisattva can't stay in either samsara or nirvana because of both wisdom and compassion. So unbounded. Unbounded, liberated existence. So again, nirvana is not a place or a state, but something like a way of seeing or a way of being or a way of living or a way of practicing, a way of acting. And it's something we enter into and do over and over and over again. It's not that we arrive there and there we are. And it's all complete and done. And we can rest on our laurels. So it's not a noun, it's a verb. And it's a verb that indicates not doing more than it indicates a kind of doing. It's a ceasing, a not engaging in unskillful behaviors which cloud the mind, a letting go, a not abiding. So ordinary beings, and ordinary beings is that word that we use in Buddhism to describe, I don't know what, people who aren't practicing or something like that. I'm not sure anybody's not practicing in some way. Ordinary beings cherish samsara, the world of birth and death. Arhants try to escape it. Bodhisattvas play in the field of samsara, not abiding anywhere, freely coming and going between birth and death, knowing that the difference between samsara and nirvana is something created by our minds. So once again, it's the way we see with our minds. And when we shift our perspective, samsara becomes nirvana. The very thing that's vexing us or that we are using to create suffering for ourselves becomes our freedom, our liberation. And the Heart Sutra is trying to say that samsara is nirvana when we dwell in perfect wisdom, when we dwell in prajnaparamita. I think I might stop there. I think I'm at a break point. I mean, a breaking point in what I'm talking about, so I don't mean I'm breaking.